Okay, first we do the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Today is July 18th, 2015. And today we'll be discussing sutta number 135 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Chulakamma Vibhanga Sutta, which means the shorter discourse on the analysis of karma. Okay, and this sutta begins on page... Yeah, 1053. Okay, and so this sutta begins when the Buddha is living in Jeta's grove in Savatthi, and the discourse starts when a young Brahmin, a Brahmin student named Subha, who's described as Todaya's son, comes to the Buddha and exchanges greetings with him. Okay, now I see what the source of the problem is. I'm sorry, it was muted. Okay, and so there's a little background story to this conversation that is related in the commentary. And as I say often about commentarial stories, sometimes have to take them with a little bit of grain of skepticism, but it's part of the tradition, so I relate it anyway. Also, the background story relates to the father of Subha, who was a Brahmin named Todaya. Excuse me, I'm laughing when I think of the story. Named Todaya. And Todaya was a chaplain of King Basenadi of Kosala. And it's said that Todaya was very stingy, very miserly, and he didn't like to give any alms to monks or wanderers, mendicants, ascetics. He always had the belief that a little bit like the common conservative line today, that what I earn is mine and there's no need to share it with anybody else. And so whenever monks, whether Buddhist monks or other wandering ascetics, would come to his house on alms round, he would chase them away and say things like, get a job, you shouldn't be sponges living off other people, you're just a bunch of parasites, worthless fellows doing nothing, no contributing nothing to society. And so when he passed away, because he got a lot of unwholesome karma as a result of his miserliness and his narrow attitude, so it's said that he was born or reborn as a dog, and the dog was adopted by his son Subha, and so Todaya became the dog living in the house of Subha. And Subha loved the dog very much. He had a very strong affection for the dog. And he provided the dog with delicious food. He had a rather luxurious bed made for the dog. And whenever ascetics, wanderers, monks would come to the house on alms round, the dog would bark at them. And so by barking, the dog would chase the ascetics away. And one time the Buddha came to Subha's house on alms round, and the dog started to bark at the Buddha. And Subha was standing, you know, outside seeing the dog barking at the Buddha. Then the Buddha said to the dog, "Be quiet, Todaya." "You're going to die soon and be reborn in hell." This sounds a very shocking statement. Okay, so when Subha heard this, he was very angry at the Buddha, not at the dog. And so he came to the Buddha and said, "How dare you speak to my dog like that? How dare you insult my father, who is a very pious Brahmin, who must have been reborn in the Brahma world? How can you say that my father, Todaya, has been a dog, has been reborn as a dog?" So the Buddha said to Subha, he said, "When your father was alive, he buried some treasure in the garden that nobody else knows about. Tell the dog, if you want that treasure, tell the dog, please show me the treasure, lead me to the treasure that my father Todaya buried. Okay, so when Subha went back to his house, then he said to the dog, "Please show me the treasure that my father, Todaya, buried." Then the dog went running out to the garden and found a certain spot in the garden and started to claw it up. And then Subha came over and continued to dig into that ground. And lo and behold, there was a chest of treasure buried there. And so this convinced Subha that indeed that his father had been reborn as the dog. And so with this, the commentary says that Subha gained sadha, trust or faith in the Buddha, and he wanted, because he understood that this came about through the workings of karma, so he wanted to understand more about the working of karma. And so he came to the Buddha and asked him a series of questions about karma. And so this is sort of the background to the sutta. So if you want to believe the commentarial story, you can believe it. If you want to see that this is just a little story that preachers had devised in order to stir up the interest of their audience, in order to get them to listen to the content of the sutta, then you could accept it in that way. Okay, but anyway, Subha comes to the Buddha and he asks a series of questions about the workings of karma. First, he asks a general question. So he says, "Master Gotama, what is the cause and condition why beings are seen to be inferior and superior?" The words used are hina and panita, low and high, inferior, superior. And then he gives more specifications. So he says, for people are seen to be short-lived and long-lived, sickly and healthy, ugly and beautiful, uninfluential and influential, or we could say powerless and powerful, poor and wealthy, low-born and high-born, stupid or foolish and wise. So what is the cause and condition for why human beings are seen to be inferior and superior? Okay, now first, the Buddha gives remember last week I made the distinction between the Udesa and Vibhanga? That is, Udesa is the summary, or Sankhitena, Desana, it's short, compressed, concise teaching, and the Vitarena Desana, the elaborated teaching, the teaching in detail. So the Buddha answers the question with an Udesa, a short statement, a summary statement, a concise explanation. He says, beings are owners of their actions. And the word translated as actions here is karma. They are heirs of their actions. See, sort of the two statements that are really the key to the whole Udesa. So the word sakka means what is one's own, one's property, let's say. And dayada is one's inheritance. So beings have karma as their property or belongings, karma as their inheritance. Then the next is translated, they originate from their actions. This in Pali, it's kama yoni. Yoni actually means, one of the meanings is the womb. So beings have karma as the womb out of which they emerge. They are bound to their actions. Or this is kama bandhu, which could also be translated, they have karma as their relatives, as their kinsmen, because just as kinsmen are closely related, you know, when you have a brother, a sister, cousin, so there's some bond or connection between you and your relative. And so when we do actions, when we create karma, that karma always remains connected to us, just like it's our own relative. And then they have actions as their refuge. Here the word used is patisarana. Of course, the word patisarana, it's connected It's related to the word sarana, which is the refuge, like we go for refuge. We take Buddhang saranang gacchami. I take refuge in the Buddha. So pati saranang is a refuge, that on which one relies, that on which one, that to which one takes recourse. And so first the Buddha makes this general statement, and then he relates the statement to the question of subha. He says it is action or karma that distinguishes beings as inferior and superior. Okay, so subha, he wanted a detailed explanation to his questions. You know, why are beings seen to be long-lived and short-lived, sickly and healthy, and so on? And yet the Buddha just gave a very concise statement. And so Subha says that, I do not understand in detail the meaning of Master Gotama's statement. And it says, which he spoke in brief. This is Sankhitena, a brief statement. It would be good if Master Gotama would teach me the Dhamma so that I might understand in detail. This is Vitarena, in the elaborate form, the meaning of Master Gotama's statement. Okay, so then the Buddha tells him to listen carefully, and now the Buddha is going to explain in detail how it is that karma distinguishes beings into the different classes as inferior and superior. And before I come to the Buddha's explanation, first we have to look a little bit into the meaning of the word karma. Okay, the word karma itself comes from the verb karoti. Equivalent, the same as the Sanskrit word karma. And the word karma had been used even before the time of the Buddha with different senses, sometimes just in the general sense of any action or deed. The Brahmins had used it in reference to the specific rites and rituals connected with, derived from the Vedas. But the Buddha gave a very particular, very specific meaning to the word karma. The Buddha said, as a famous statement in the Anguttara Nikaya, Chetanaham Bhikkhave Kamang Vadami. And here the key word is Chetana. Chetana means volition. And so the Buddha says that it is volition that I call karma. And this means that for the Buddha, the key factor in the creation of karma is the quality of the volition. Volition is the will, or the intention, or mental determination behind the action. And so, the way the Buddha sees it, all actions, bodily actions, verbal actions, mental actions, originate from, in order to be karmically significant, all actions originate from and express volition. If there is no volition, then no karma is created. For example, if I'm walking down the path and I step on ants, I have no intention, I don't know that they are there, I don't see them, but as a result of my step, they die. I'm not creating the karma of killing. If in my sleep there's a mosquito on my back and I turn over and I crush the mosquito, I'm not aware of it, no intention of killing it, no karma is created. I see an umbrella and I think it's mine and I take the umbrella. I have no intention of taking somebody else's umbrella, so it's not an act of stealing. And this might seem obvious to us, but in the Buddha's time, this interpretation of karma was almost directly opposed to the view of the rival school, which was the school of the Jains. The Jains held that any kind of action, whether intentional or not, creates karma. And so for the Jains, if one accidentally steps on ants, accidentally breathes in an insect and it dies, one is creating unwholesome karma. And so that's why for the Jains, the kind of ideal was to completely abstain from action. And so even today, the Jain ascetics in India always wear, sometimes if you've seen photographs of them, they will wear a face mask over them, or a cloth over the mouth to prevent them from breathing in any kind of invisible living beings, because they believe that if they breathe in invisible beings, you know, sub-microscopic beings, and those beings die, that they're creating karma. Okay, so the Buddha identified sort of the key factor in karma as volition. But he didn't hold that just volition on itself, by itself, necessarily creates karma. But the karma, or the action that stems from volition, will be expressed in three ways: through body, speech, and purely mental karma. Karma that remains just as thoughts, plans, emotions, ideas in the mind, but doesn't come to expression through bodily action or verbal action. Okay, and then having distinguished karma through the three channels or three doors, then the Buddha makes a distinction, another way of distinguishing karma, and that is according to its ethical quality. And so here the primary distinction in karma is between unwholesome karma and wholesome karma. Unwholesome karma is action which creates suffering and hardship for, it could be for oneself, or for others, or for both. And wholesome karma is karma which leads to the well-being of oneself, the well-being of others, the well-being of both. And what distinguishes karma as wholesome or unwholesome? Of course, we have behind both unwholesome and wholesome karma, we have chaitanya volition. But what distinguishes the volition as being unwholesome or wholesome? Anybody know?
The intent?
Well, the intent is, intention is virtually the same as volition.
Is it the view?
Not exactly.
Expectation?
Perception?
Expectation?
No, no.
Craving or aversion?
Very close.
Perception, huh?
No, he was very close with craving and aversion, but there are, usually we make, have a group of three factors. We call them the roots. Yeah, so action stems from roots. From the unwholesome comes from the unwholesome roots, which are greed, aversion, and delusion. And the wholesome comes from the wholesome karma comes from wholesome roots, which in the negative are expressed as non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. But more positively, we could say non-greed is seen in acts of generosity as well as renunciation, non-hatred in kindness, loving kindness, compassion, and non-delusion in wisdom, insight, wise understanding. Okay, so this gives us a kind of broad overview about what is meant by karma. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to take specific types of karma and show what kind of results flow from that karma and how the different types of karma distinguish beings into in terms of different results. So he takes the case, here we're in paragraph 5. So here, student, some man or woman kills living beings and is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. So this is the more elaborate explanation of the simple statement that somebody is one who habitually and regularly takes life, doing so with a mind of cruelty. Okay, because of performing and undertaking such action, on the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears or is reborn in a state of deprivation. A state, what's called a state of deprivation, means a bad destiny, a lower realm of rebirth. In an unhappy destination, in perdition, or the lower world, even in hell. But then the text continues, but if on the dissolution of the body after death, he is not reborn in a state of deprivation in the lower world, but instead comes back to the human state, then wherever he is reborn, he is short-lived. He has a short lifespan. This is the way, student, that leads to short lifespan. Namely, one kills living beings and is murderous, bloody-handed. And so forth. Okay, now to understand this passage, we have to understand different ways in which karma functions. And the texts distinguish in terms of function four functions of karma. And the four functions are explained, I don't want the people to get confused, but they're explained differently from an Abhidhamma point of view and from a Sutta point of view. So here I'm going to, because last year I gave, in the Abhidhamma retreat, I gave the explanation from the Abhidhamma point of view. Now I'm giving the explanation from the Sutta point of view. So the four functions are okay, productive means this is the function by which the karma produces the rebirth. So rebirth into different realms and into different conditions, even within the human realm, comes from a particular karma. And that karma, in bringing about the mode of rebirth, is said to be exercising the productive function. So each of us has been reborn as a human being because of a particular karma, and that karma, by bringing us into the human realm, has been exercising or performing the productive function. Okay, the oppressive function is the function that a karma will exercise during the course of a lifetime. And the oppressive function would be that the karma is not producing the rebirth itself, but during the course of life, the karma produces a lot of problems and difficulties. For example, the karma will produce, you know, if somebody is a businessman and they undertake business, they meet with constant failures, problems, trouble, losses, poor investments, crashes in their enterprises. Somebody is a farmer, there will be poor crops, droughts, floods, loss of income. Or somebody can be sickly, have a lot of health problems in the course of life. Okay, so this will be the oppressive function of karma. The supportive function is it's just the opposite of that. The supportive function of karma, this is the role of karma in bringing about extra beneficial results in the course of the lifetime. So, you know, some people go into business, they hardly do any, I don't know if it works this way, but some people, maybe they don't make special effort, but suddenly, like, everything works to their advantage. Like maybe 30, 40 years ago, there were a group of guys who were building a little computer in the garage. And suddenly it takes off and one of them becomes Steve Jobs, right? One who, the little computer turns into the Apple computer and then everything takes off. And how does he, probably there were 50 to 100 guys building computers in their garages. So why is it that one particular guy or couple of guys, their project takes off and becomes a great success? Whereas I remember years ago we had WordStar, and we had, I remember when I was in Sri Lanka in the 1980s, we had so many different computers and so many different operating systems, like all of them have just faded into oblivion, and just a few computers, just computer systems have taken off and dominated the whole market. We have, you know, like a, maybe 1960s in Great Britain, there were a whole bunch of these little musical groups, rock groups, you know, experimenting with new style of music. And suddenly, like, all of the attention focuses on one or two particular groups, and sort of they take off into, like, superstar. Well, they are superstars, sort of like comets flying into the sky. And one of them becomes the Beatles. And they have, that's like a comet that just flares. And within a few years, they're gone. What, 10 years, they're gone. Whereas another is still shooting through the sky. Dina, who is that?
The Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yes. 70 years old. You know, probably.
More,
yeah. But I remember when.
Some are my age. I think that's my age.
Yeah, so why do they take off? It must be some kind of, at least one factor is some really powerful karma. Okay, so this is supportive karma. And then the destructive karma is said to be a karma that comes out of nowhere, sort of. And at least we see it most clearly where it brings about a premature death. Like just the other day, Carolyn told me about this accident that took place at Goshen. Just some young people in a car taking driving lessons, and then another vehicle came from another direction out of nowhere, and three kids were killed. So, you know, without an understanding of karma, it would just completely tear up my heart. But when one looks at this from the light of karma, we could say there must be some explanation behind it. And then sometimes when there's a crash like that, a few people will be killed, but somebody else, maybe a couple of people, will emerge intact, maybe with just little scratches and bruises, but they're able to come out and survive and to live the rest of their life.
So does the Buddha state that everything that happens to you is due to your previous intentional actions?
Okay, that's a good question, but I think let's go through the scheme here and then bring that question up. Okay, so now, according to the workings of the law of karma, an unwholesome karma, if it takes on the productive role, that is the role of generating rebirth, it has to generate a rebirth into the lower realms. That is, we have the lower realms. Okay, so the unwholesome karma will produce a rebirth into the lower realms, and the lower realms would be the hells, the animal realm, and the sphere of the pretas, sometimes translated as the hungry ghosts. But that's a little too specific. I like to use the afflicted spirits. And a wholesome karma, if it takes on the productive role in generating rebirth, it will bring rebirth into one of the good destinations or the happy realms. That would be rebirth into the human realm or into one of the divine or celestial heavenly realms. Okay, so in the passage which we have here, if on the dissolution of the body, we have, because of performing and undertaking such action, that is the killing, taking of life, on the dissolution of the body after death, he is reborn in a state of deprivation. This is referring to the case where the karma of killing takes on the productive role. If that karma takes on the productive role, then it will produce rebirth. Since it's an unwholesome karma, it will produce rebirth into one of the lower realms. But it's possible that the person performs other wholesome karmas. And so, in fact, in the course of life, we all have like combinations of wholesome and unwholesome deeds. So if a person has a predominance, or at least a good proportion of wholesome karma, and so some wholesome karma takes on the role, the productive function, the role of generating rebirth, then the person, as a result of the wholesome karma, can be reborn in the good realms, one of the good realms, say, in the human realm. But even though he is reborn as a result of a wholesome karma, but the actions of taking life still remain stored up, say, in the deep levels of the mind, in the mental continuum. And so that karma can gain the opportunity to produce its results in the course of life, the course of the human existence. And then it can take on the oppressive function, creating all sorts of obstacles and hardships for the person. So that the person might get beaten up by others, abused and reviled by others, meet with problems in family life, business life, health problems. All of this, these are coming about because through the maturation of the unwholesome, or could be coming about because of the maturation of that unwholesome karma in its oppressive function. But it can also happen that that unwholesome karma takes on an even stronger function, and then it takes on the destructive function. So even though the person might be living a healthy, what seems to be a happy, healthy, successful life as a human being, but that destructive karma is hidden there in the background, and when the opportunity arises, boom, it matures and takes his life. So we have a relatively young man, a senator from Massachusetts, who, against all odds in 1960, well, not against all odds, but in 1960, he gets elected President of the United States. you know, the most powerful position in the world. He has a beautiful wife, two nice children. And people like him on the whole. And then he goes on a trip to Texas and boom, 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 assassination. So we could say, you know, looking at this through the lens of karma, this would be like a very strong, wholesome, productive karma, a lot of supportive karma coming in, but hiding in the background, destructive karma, getting the opportunity to mature. And then in the prime of life, what was he, about 45 years old, comes to an end. Okay, then let's just take the opposite of this now. And then I'll ask for questions. Now we take sort of the counterpart case. Okay, here some man or woman abandoning the killing of living beings, abstains from killing living beings, with rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly, he abides compassionate to all living beings. Okay, so this is somebody who deliberately, motivated by loving kindness and compassion, deliberately abstains from destroying life. Makes the determination not to kill living beings. And though it might seem that abstaining from killing living beings is just a negation of an action, just desisting from the action of killing living beings, but actually that, in the case that's being depicted here, the act of abstaining or desisting from killing living beings comes about through an act of determination. It comes about through a deliberate intention not to kill living beings. And so that determination, I will not kill living beings, or that attitude of kindness and compassion, that I feel sympathy, empathy with living beings, so I won't harm them or kill them under any conditions, that determination generates a very powerful, wholesome, or positive karma. And so that's why it says, because of performing and undertaking such action, even though the person might not, you know, meet with conditions where they're tempted to take life, but just that forming that determination, and within the Buddhist context, it's done repeatedly whenever one undertakes the precepts. So if every day one makes that determination, one undertakes the precepts, panati pata viramanisi kapadang samadhiyami, I undertake the precept or the training rule to abstain from taking life, then one is creating that powerful, wholesome karma of not killing living beings. And so that mental determination, that mental volition, is infusing or imbuing the mind with very positive, wholesome karmic force. So because of performing and undertaking such action, creating that karma of not taking life, on the dissolution of the body after death, that being or person reappears in a happy destination. It is one of the fortunate realms of rebirth, either in under good conditions in the human realm or in one of the celestial divine realms. This is taking the case where the person, as a result of performing that wholesome karma, is reborn in one of the heavenly realms. Because then comes the qualification. But if on the dissolution of the body after death, he does not reappear in a happy destination in the heavenly world, but instead comes back to the human state, then wherever he is reborn, he is long-lived. So this is the way that leads to long life, namely abandoning the killing of living beings, one abstains from killing living beings, and so on. So actually, what I would say is that the karma of abstaining from killing living beings, if it takes up it can take on the productive function. If it takes on the productive function, then it will produce rebirth into the good realms, that is, the heavenly realm or the human realm. So the sutta is taking the preeminent case of the wholesome karma producing rebirth in the heavenly realm, and then it takes, in the secondary case, a rebirth in the human realm. But both of these are following from the productive function of the wholesome karma. It will take, produces rebirth either in the heavenly realm, if it's powerful enough, if it's weaker, it produces a rebirth in the human realm. But that karma of abstaining from taking life could also be serving in the supportive role. So if it's functioning in the supportive role, then for a human being, apart from the human rebirth, it will also be producing all sorts of good results in the human realm, additional good results. So one, especially abstaining from killing living beings, so one would be likely to have good health and to have a long lifespan as a human being. Okay, it's possible, though, that the productive karma produces rebirth as a human being, but then some other unwholesome karma, even karma of harming and killing living beings, takes on the oppressive role and then counteracts the good result implicit in the human rebirth. Wait, let me just finish, then I'll ask for questions. Okay, so this case where one comes back to the human state, and then when one is reborn with a long lifespan, so one could conjecture that that long lifespan is the result of the karma of abstaining from killing living beings. It's possible, I could conceive this, that because the person has abstained from killing living beings, they have a long lifespan, but maybe in still another existence, they oppressed and harmed living beings, so they've created oppressive karma. So they might have a long lifespan, but because of the oppressive karma, they've met a lot of illness in the course of their life. Yeah, I think, you know, I could think of a few cases of people with very long lifespan, but had a lot of illness in the course of their life. So perhaps that came from, you know, two karmas working in different, two karmic accumulations working in different directions. The wholesome karma producing the long lifespan, the unwholesome karma causing repeated bouts of illness in the course of the lifespan. Okay, maybe at this point I'll ask for questions. Okay, I'll take Chris's question, but maybe first you ask your question, because Chris's is a big question. Yeah, I saw that. Sam has it there. What is your name?
John.
John.
Just one confusion among many. Karma almost seems like an entity into itself, like there's something that propels it, but it's not self. So I'm just wondering, what is this entity that kind of binds it and pushes it forward? Okay. And secondly, it almost seems like you're saying it's multi-determined, like it could be several lifetimes impinging upon several different kinds of karma. What is that that forms or propels it through?
Okay, these are big questions. Let's take them one at a time. Okay, first, is karma something like a thing in itself? I don't want to say karma is a thing in itself, but let us say that according to the Buddha, like one of the laws of sentient existence, of conscious existence in the universe, is the law of karma, according to which our volitions, our volitional actions, have this tendency to produce a result which corresponds to the ethical quality of the action. So that it's almost like a kind of action and reaction principle operating in the sphere, not of physical matter, like the laws of physics, but operating in the sphere of willed, morally significant willed actions. So that the actions we perform will, in some way, through the operation of this law, come back to us over the course of lifetimes, whether in this life or in future lives, and produce a result which reflects, corresponds to, mirrors the ethical quality of the original action. Where does karma... Then you mentioned that karma seems to imply some kind of self. Okay, now, according to Buddhism, that there's no substantial self as a self-identical entity, a substantial entity, which remains from life to life. But there is a stream of consciousness, so that in the course of any life, you know, this life right now, I don't have a substantial self, something bhante, like a solid rock. But there is this consciousness which is always changing from moment to moment. But now, because of the causal continuity from one moment to the next, there is some kind of identity within that stream of consciousness. So the identity is established on the basis of the cause and effect relationship between different occasions of experience. We can say the conditionality between earlier moments of experience and the present moment of experience. Now, according to Buddhism, this continuity of consciousness doesn't come to an end with the death of the physical body, but the body functions as a support for the stream of consciousness. And when the body biologically is unable to support the stream of consciousness, the body falls away, it perishes, but the stream of consciousness then continues on. And the stream of consciousness, where it goes, how it's reborn, what happens to it, that is governed by karma. Where does the karma exist? In early Buddhism, that question doesn't come up and it's not really answered. It's just kept as, the assumption is that once karma is created, it just remains as a potentiality to produce the result. And when it produces the result, then the karma will be exhausted. Then you have the second question. Now, I've answered the first, but I forgot.
Just in response to that, it's like almost like fireworks. Fireworks, almost like an impersonal bombardment. All these actions. Yeah. That's what that was the second question about. Is it? That's kind of confusing. It's almost like it's impersonal. It's non-self. It's still it's almost like a bombardment.
You have to put the microphone there.
It's almost like a personal bombardment of actions. impersonal bombardment actions, almost like a fireworks that's continuously going on.
Yeah, I say the stream of consciousness is individualized, and so the working of karma is individualized. Though it's individualized, though without an underlying self. And so karma will produce, in the course of a person's experience, it will produce its fruits, its results. And then in response to those results, the person will act in other ways, which will create new karma. And that karma will remain as a potentiality which will produce still further results. So there's a stream of karma and its results, which continues in continuity, though without a permanent substantial self underlying it. Okay, Chris, you had your question.
I don't think. So my question was, does everything that happens to us in our life, is everything that happens to us a result of our previous intentional actions?
Yeah, this is a good question. Does everything that happens to us happen to us as a result of karma, as the result of our intentional action? And this is a question where I have to say, I don't know. No, very frankly. And I don't say that if we base on the early Buddhist discourses that we could answer that definitely and say that everything that happens to us happens as a result of karma. In fact, there is a sutta that occurs in this Sangyutta Nikaya. It's a little bit problematic sutta, where a wanderer comes to the Buddha and asks whether everything that happens happens as a result of karma. And the Buddha denies that, and he gives his examples, eight causes of like affliction that happen to people. And he says, it's generally accepted in the world, and you know for yourself, that people become ill as a result of, he uses the old Indian system of medical diagnosis, as a result of disorders of the bile, disorders of phlegm, disorders of wind, disorders of all three together, as a result of accidents, as a result of careless behavior. And then just the last one that he gives is that people fall ill as a result of karma, the maturation of karma. Now this seems, as I say, it seems a little problematic to me, because if somebody is repeatedly getting ill from, whether from bile, from phlegm, or from what seem to be accidents, you know, we could, probably if one inquires into that, you could see that there's a karmic reason behind that illness. So the answer seems a little difficult to square with other things in the Buddha's teaching. But I still find it difficult to believe that everything that happens to us happens as a result of karma. I get bit by a mosquito and I get a little annoying pain that night. Is that the result of the karma? I'm walking down the street and the dog comes out and bites me. Is that the result of a karma? I'd only have to say it could be, it could not be, or it might not be. Then we come to like really big problems. This is where I find some really difficulties. Like, okay, the Holocaust, which you know, eliminates six million Jewish people in Central and Eastern Europe, the killing fields in Cambodia, where 2 million people are killed. Can we say that all of this is happening because of karma? I just find this really problematic. But so when I think about karma, I think about it this way. Not trying to reason from what is happening in the present back to the past and saying, this must be due to some bad karma, or this must be the result of some good karma. But rather I reason from the present going into, or reflect from the present going to the future, that if I commit unwholesome actions, then if those actions get to produce their results, they're going to bring suffering and hardship for me. And if I do good actions in the present, then when those actions mature, they're going to bring well-being and happiness. So for myself, that is sufficient as a guide. I don't have to start reflecting back from the present into the past. Dina.
I have two questions.
Let us take the microphone.
Microphone. Thank you. Is there some kind of immediate karma? You smoke and you get, something happened, you decided you smoked unintentionally. You smoke cigarettes?
Yeah.
Remember when the doctor said camels were good for you?
More doctors smoke camels than any other cigarette.
More doctors smoke camels than any other cigarette. So you think, well, I'll smoke some camels. Right?
Yeah.
And you get emphysema. Can karma happen right there on the spot is basically my question.
Yeah, okay. There is what is called Dita Dhammika karma. This is karma which produces its result in this lifetime. Yeah, so karma can produce its result in this lifetime. But I say that emphysema or lung cancer that result from smoking, that is not a karmic result, or it's not the karmic result of smoking. It's a result purely at the physiological, biological level. I say that is not a karmic result.
My second question really goes way, way back and is basic. But who determines delusion? What is delusion? If you may see it one way, I may see it another way. How is it really determined?
Okay, what is delusion? Delusion, okay, it's also...
I tried to look it up, but...
So in Buddhist terms, we would say that delusion is...
lack of understanding.
Yeah, not seeing things as they really are, not understanding things as they are, or understanding things in a distorted way. So, at least on the basis of the Buddhist text, it would be... included under delusion would be taking things to be permanent that are really impermanent, taking things to be sources of stable happiness that are not really sources of stable happiness, taking things to be a self, I, me, and mine that are not truly myself. So that's one level at which we could understand delusion. So it's not, it's not determined by the Buddha in the sense that the Buddha creates a fixed definition of delusion, but from the standpoint of the Buddhist text, that's what's meant by delusion. Okay, Chris?
One thing. Going back to when we talk about the abandonment of killing living beings, I understand that you kill in this lifetime, let's say a farmer or a hunter kills in this lifetime, but then cuts that defilement off in this very life at the root. It determines, could be productive for their next lifetime, but if they abstain in that next lifetime, does it not produce going forward lifetimes after that? Does it determine?
Go over the question again, I want to make sure that I catch it.
If you cut off the defilement of killing in this very life.
You mean somebody has been a hunter earlier or a fisherman?
Yes.
Then he comes to the conclusion that this is wrong, morally unwholesome, and then he makes the determination to abstain from that. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay. And then the question is whether his previous actions will produce results in the future. In future lives.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, the thing is, like, once karmic actions are created, then they still have a capacity to produce results in the future. But if one engages, well, the relationships are very complex. So if one engages in a lot of wholesome action, it could actually completely obliterate the bad that bad karma so that it doesn't produce its results. That might happen. Or what could happen is that it weakens the results, or it weakens the capacity of those unwholesome karmas to produce their results. So when they do produce their results, the result will be milder than it would be if one just continued along that kind of behavior. And so somebody who took living beings, who was killing living beings, creating unwholesome karma, which a tendency to be short-lived, say. So in midlife, he changes his way of life, undertakes the precept or training rule to abstain from taking life. He feels regret, remorse over taking life. He generates, maybe practices loving meditations on loving kindness and compassion. So he's creating a lot of wholesome karma. So now maybe when, in a future life, when that karma of taking life was to produce its result, instead of having a short lifespan, maybe he'll get bitten by a dog, maybe need rabies shots, which are painful for 7 days, and then it's over, and then that karma is exhausted, maybe. But also there are some types of unwholesome karma which, it's said, retain their capacity forever until one gains final liberation. So the famous account of that in the discourses or in the tradition is that of Moggallana, who many, many aeons in the past had taken the lives of his parents. And then as a result of that, he was reborn in hell, but he still had a residue of that karma which remained there, trailing him life after life. And within that, from that time afterwards, he became a follower of past Buddha and then was constantly cultivating the Dharma under many, many Buddhas till during the time of Gautama or Shakyamuni Buddha, he became the chief disciple of the Buddha. But that unwholesome karma was still there, and just in that last, his final lifespan after becoming an arhat, it gained the opportunity to ripen. And so he was assassinated. You know, there was a gang of criminals who were sent to kill him, it said, and they assassinated him.
Thank you, Bhante.
Debbie, and way in the back. Oh, you have a question.
I'm taking advice to what Chris was asking, is everything common? I heard once a monk say that there are like 4 or 5 determining or factors in that. One, it's our past karma. 2, it would be the other person's karma and how they choose it comes to fruition. And then also the karma we are creating in this life. So it's not just, oh, it's past karma, everything is past karma.
Yeah.
It's ripening in our lives. It's also other factors, because if not, then everything is predestined.
Yeah, certainly karma is not predestination.
Right.
And that, or maybe what he meant is that there are other things that affect how or whether karma ripens.
Right.
Let me see if I could remember what they are.
You know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about. There was a set of 5 factors. I don't remember what they all are, but there are, you know, a whole multiplicity of factors which determine whether the karma is going to ripen, if it ripens, in what way it's going to ripen. Okay, Debbie, she has the pink. From here, it looks like a pink shirt in the back.
Bhante, I have so many questions and concerns about this. But I'm going to limit myself to one. Which,
okay.
Having a little trouble. Which is my concern that not only does this explanation of karma explain different stations in life, inferior, superior lives, but it also can be used, certainly, to justify justify
oppression,
suffering,
social
and economic inequalities. I'm sure it has been used that way. I have no historian. I don't know much about the East, but certainly in the West, it comes down to, it could certainly come down to blaming the victim and for wealthy, powerful people to congratulate themselves.
I have to say that I agree with that 100%. But I think one has to understand that this is the way I deal with it, that there is a certain lawfulness working that determines a certain lawfulness working that establishes a relationship between our karmic, our volitional actions and our, call it our destinations in life, our experiences in life, and that there is validity to that operation between the two. At the same time, I think one has to see that this does not provide a justification for what you call blaming the victim or for people in positions of privilege to congratulate themselves. But this is a problem, I think we'll see it more clearly with the rest of the sutta. Originally I thought that I could take this whole sutta in one day, but I see it's going to extend over till next week. And I think some of those problems will come up very clearly in some of the other stipulations that come later in the sutta, particularly in relation to what's called, because it's explained against the background of Indian society of the period, high birth and low birth, which brings your relations to the class or caste system. Yes, please. And please take the microphone. And your name again?
Christine.
Oh, Christine, okay.
So my interpretation of this is, yes, there are the karma that you have, but then you also have, in this present life, understanding that the karma is coming into fruition, but then also understanding that you have the ability to make certain choices in your life, not to be like, well, I have cancer because that's my karma. For example, the smoking or whatever. So for me, my interpretation is that you have cancer because you're smoking. So the chances are you getting cancer is much greater than somebody that isn't smoking. So it's taking accountability of your actions on what you do in this present lifetime. So it's not always the karma that's happened to you, it's still the choices that you make every single day and every intention that you have. So to be that aware of, because for me I'm processing a lot of information, and to be that aware of every action has that reaction. So it's a lot to always be in that openness and that awareness. And it takes a lot of energy. Because for me, I'm trying to be as present as I could be every day, every moment, and understanding that there is such greatness.
Such
greatness in just being and being present. It's overwhelming in a very nice way. It's very fulfilling. So you feel that I am kind of on the visual of seeing truth.
The
visual of seeing truth.
Yeah.
So sometimes you wonder, am I really thinking clearly? But what I was interpreting from the other one is that you're thinking clearly if you're able to see no fear, no hatred, no greed, none of those other bad defilements. And if you're in a wholesome way of love and kindness and giving, then you're able to see clearly. That's my interpretation of it.
What the implication of the karma doctrine, the way it's explained in relation to volition as the determining factor, is that one has to be mindful, aware of one's intentions in action, because it's the intentions that create the karma. And you know, what comes to us in the present, what we, the experiences we undergo sort of involuntarily, you know, whether it's the result of our karma or not, that we can't know for sure, but we have to sort of respond to these consequences in a wholesome way. Okay, it's time for us to take the break now for the lunch. We could come back, we'll come back here, say 12:15, then we could have some further discussion. But as I mentioned, there's still the rest of the sutta that we'll take next week. I was worried that we were going to go through the sutta too quickly. I'll be finished after a half an hour. Okay, so we'll end with sharing the merits. So we share the merits with the Dhamma-protecting devas, the nagas, the fear spirits or buddhas, and with all beings, wishing them to be well, happy, and free from harm and suffering. Chirang rakantu sasanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mamparam Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabe devanumodantu Sabha sampati siddhya Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabe bhutanumodantu Sabha sampati siddhya Etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam Sabe satanu modantu Sabha sampati siddhya Pavagupadaya vichyetato Etantare satakayupapana Rupiya rupicha sanya sanino Tukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin Okay, now we end with three half hours.
Thank you.